morning, and thank you all for taking the time to share your thoughts on this issue that is not only a source of income for many of you, but it is the issue of health care is something that affects every individual and family in this country, and as you know, has become a real leading issue for the President as well as Congress. But they have set a very important timetable for getting some legislation done on health care reform. What Senator Harkin has asked is that his staff, both his state and Washington staff, take the time to visit all 99 counties across Iowa. We will have multiple meetings in some counties to talk with health care providers, hospital administrators, insurance companies, and consumers of health care, which are actually all of us, about where this reform effort needs to go. I'm going to just give you a little bit of history on what this process will entail. The current bill in the Senate, there are two bills because two committees are involved in this. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee has jurisdiction over private health insurance plans as well as public health systems. There is also the Senate Finance Committee, who oversees government health programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and SHIP. Both of those respective committees have presented the bill. Yesterday, I know that they started the markup process. And for us, that means that this is an opportunity for every senator to review the bill, which actually has been out for about 2 weeks now, to review that bill and to make comments to committee members about their opinions on what is in the bill, what should be in the bill, what they don't like about the bill. The important part of this, though, is that every senator has an opportunity to have input in this. So we encourage everyone, if you've got strong opinions, you need to be talking to all of your elected officials about this most important issue. How this process works is that the bill is in, is through this, going through this markup process. Once they have come up with a completed bill and all the language is figured out, then the Senate will be voting. They will combine the bills, and then the Senate will have an opportunity to vote on that that portion of the bill. The House, the other side of Congress, will also be coming out with their own bill or bills and go through a similar process. And once that, their process is done, the House and the Senate bills will be combined in a process called a conference report. They take the common aspects of those bills and come up with language for a final bill. When the conference report is done, again, they will go back to both the Senate floor and the House floor. They will have a full vote on those bills. And if they're both voted in favor, then a bill will be sent to the President for signature. The President has set a pretty lofty timetable. He has asked that a bill be on his desk in October for signature. And I know there's been some comments about what is the rush into doing this and why October is that the goal. There's two issues I think that are important that everybody understand. Healthcare reform is not an issue that people in Washington or in Iowa started talking about on January 20th with the change in administration. Healthcare reform has been an issue that your senators have been talking about for decades. We have known that there are issues that need to be addressed, and little by little we have tried to kind of chip away at some of the problems that we've seen and encourage some of the changes. But it no longer is effective, and that this administration, and really just about the majority, well, I think it was 74% New York Times poll showed, is 74% of Americans believe that there needs to be a dramatic change in the way we deliver health care in this country. So that is really not the big debate here. It's how that change is going to be go about. So what we need to look at, the urgency, I guess, is that, if you want to call it some urgency, is because the system continues to lack in its what its main purpose was supposed to do. It's estimated that some 46 to 50 affects your family. You may know of a neighbor or another family member, extended family member that this impacted. In the United States, we spend approximately $2 trillion annually on health care. That is 16.5% of our gross domestic product on health care. And the fact remains is that we still are a country that is plagued with chronic disease. And we can do better, and we must do better with this SOCIS Center. Oh, I get a note that I jotted down here a couple months ago of the Kaiser Foundation released some figures that show that in Iowa alone, of those uninsured, there are 290,000 Iowans alone who go without health insurance. So this is one of the reasons Senator Harkin sees the urgency in addressing this. Other numbers, I hate to bore you with numbers, but this has an economic toll as well as a personal toll. 62% of all bankruptcies that are filed in the United States have some connection to medical bills that they simply cannot afford. And of those, over 50% of those of that percentage are people who actually have health insurance. It just was not enough, or it did not cover pre-existing conditions. We can do better. I just want to tell you a couple of things that Senator Harkin sees as vital importance that must be included in this bill. The first one, and hopefully this will put some consumers and some in the health profession to rest, Tom wants to build on what works. We have insurance policies that work for some consumers, but not for everyone. This process does not eliminate private insurance companies. Some of the proposals that are in this actually what they do is encourage the strengthening of private insurance companies and the care that they do provide. Secondly, Senator Harkin wants to make sure that health insurance works for everyone, not just the healthy and the wealthy. We need to extend health care coverage, and we need to make sure that that coverage meets the basic medical needs of the people. And the bill will also eliminate private insurance companies' ability to exclude certain treatments and services due to pre-existing conditions. I have heard some absolute horror stories of families who are in the process of a catastrophic illness and wanting to seek treatment, and they only to find out that the insurance policy that they are paying hundreds of dollars into every month will not cover what they really are needing. It is causing great hardship for these families, and we need to change that. And the other thing, one of the other things that Senator Harkin also wants to do is make sure that we are strengthening our healthcare workforce. This bill does have include provisions so that we can increase the number of doctors and nurse practitioners, nurses, physicians, assistants, pharmacists, oral and health, mental health providers, public health professionals. But we need to make sure that those aren't just in metropolitan areas. We need to make sure that healthcare is available to people in small towns as well as rural communities. Tom sees that one of the most important aspects of healthcare reform in his eyes is to refocus our repayment system. I don't know whether it doesn't matter who you talk to about it. What we currently do in reimbursing and paying for healthcare is that we pay for the sick care. He has said numerous times we don't have a healthcare system in this country. We have a sick care system. We spend millions, trillions of dollars every year. 95% of all healthcare dollars that are spent in the United States are spent after someone becomes ill, and we spend so little on preventative care, and this is a major focus of his work on this bill in committee, and he'd like to hear from you all on your thoughts about that. But the other part of it is that our current system, whether it's a government Medicare, Medicaid plan, or private insurers, is that we almost penalize physicians who provide quality wellness care. It's about keeping people healthy, and that's what it's supposed to be. But we have somewhere along the line, we have lost that focus, and that we don't allow physicians to do that job or organizations, but we don't compensate doctors for the efforts that they and all healthcare professionals for their efforts to keep people from getting acutely ill. The fourth issue that Senator Harkin and I alluded to this before is really a focus on the wellness portion of our healthcare system, and that you know, there are so many wonderful programs that are out there, and that we need to take to grow upon those programs, to look at what is working in this country, and to encourage other health systems, other states, whatever it is, to improve what they are doing. But Tom sees this not as just an issue for health professionals to address. These are issues that need to be addressed by communities. These are issues that also need to be addressed in the workplace, and that we need to have incentives to business people, whether it's in tax incentives or what, to include wellness programs in the workplace. Tom has had an opportunity to talk with some business folks about what their companies are doing, and more companies are getting on board because they see the direct correlation to productivity and a reduction in lost time by their willingness to put in wellness programs. We need to encourage workers to do that, but we also need to encourage communities. And one of the ways that Senator Harkin sees this happening is with Department of Transportation funding. We're talking about a social shift here, that we're going to have to start thinking about taking care of ourselves better, about the personal responsibility in that. And if a community can step forward and says that, that you know, they're asking for transportation dollars to put in a new road, that they will also be required to see that there is a sidewalk that is that goes along, so that you know somebody who, instead of driving three blocks to go pick up a half a gallon of milk or something, they can walk to the store to pick that up. Again, it is a social shift, but we can achieve those. There was a study done by a department at Yale University that showed that a minimal investment of $10 per individual per year could show a cost savings in the United States of $2.8 billion. If we would just make that investment, stretch that out over the years, what we invest, the payback is more. So I guess it's kind of a pay me now or pay me later kind of system. But there, when you look at it, it's about quality of life as well. And instead of people having to live with chronic illnesses, let's see what we can do in advance to help them. I'm going to save you from a lot of this stuff. I just wanted to let you know that Senator Harkin is very committed to making this a proposal that works for Iowans. And so he really has asked us to come to listen to you all and to find out, you know, if I can answer some questions, I'll be happy to. I am not the end-all expert on this, so we will try to get answers to any questions you might have. But also to take back comments to him about personal situations or just overall viewpoints we have. And I have to thank Penny, who took some time out of her busy morning to meet with me and shared a lot of really, really good points. And Penny, I will be more than happy to take those back to Tom for you. But please join in. So really, I'll turn it over to you all.
Yeah.
Well, you may still comment about Tom Harkin wanting us to let you know what we think about this health plan.
Uh-huh.
I did just that on May the 8th, I sent Tom Harkin a letter.
Okay.
I sent one to Grassley, and I sent one to Bruce Brady. Brady's the only one that was courteous enough to reply to me. I haven't heard a thing from Harkin.
Okay.
This morning in the news, to get around with what you're talking about with Obama and what he wants to do, just today, Obama has now said he will consider signing that tax on our health insurance that they want to put in. And that is going to ruin a whole bunch of us people if he does that. Also, the insurance industry and the health industry have sent a note this morning to them telling them that if they go through this plan that they have right now, that there will be thousands and thousands of people left without insurance because the people cannot afford it. Another thing right here that Mr. Brady said, and I appreciate his letter, he said he is against this tax in our health care benefits. Okay? All right? This morning in that news, but he says he's against it, and what I hear you saying, maybe Tom Harkin is saying, he's going to go along with whatever the other people want as far as tax and health benefits. In the ruling that the EEOC made, said that it is not going to be age discrimination if companies elect to drop the benefits because of the new established tax on health insurance by Congress. So what they're saying is, the insurance that I'm about right now, through the company I retired from, they have the right to, if this passes, to drop it because they won't pay the tax on it.
Because the company won't pay the tax.
Right. Then I have got to pay the tax. But if the company drops it, then there's no tax to be paid. Now, I cannot afford to pay taxes on health insurance or anything else the way the state of Iowa is taxing us now. Here in the state of Iowa, we pay tax on your Social Security. You pay tax on your pension. You pay your state tax. They're just taxing us to death. And us people that are retirees that are living on a fixed income, and that was made specifically here in Mr. Brady, he said he has no intention to put any further burden on our nation's retirees and senior citizens who live on fixed income. Now that's good from Brady. Where is my reply from Tom Harkin telling me what he thinks about what I asked him?
Well, I apologize that you haven't received a timely response. I can see 2 weeks since I get back to the office.
I'm just saying, where we stand, us retirees, and you look every day, and you look at the hospitals, and you look at the people that are already cutting back on their staff. They cannot afford to keep the people they have now. And the new plan goes through, your Medicare is going to be cut, your prescriptions are going to be cut, everything's going to be cut, and thousands of more people are going to be without jobs. Just like in your auto industry and some of the other places. Now, us retirees, we cannot stand that. We're on a fixed income, and every time you turn around, they're taxing some more. More tax and more tax against what little bit of money we get now.
I don't know of any portion of this bill that says that the services that you currently are provided for through a Medicare or Medicaid system are going to be reduced. So I hope that you can rest assured that that's not happening.
Well, already, if you look at what a doctor gets paid, compared to if I walk in there with my insurance and you just have Medicare because my son is on that, they pay very, very little compared to what my insurance pays. These people, these hospitals cannot keep up operating the way they're operating. Already, Genesis last year, I think if I remember right, spent something like $40 million in the hole because of people they had to take care of because they didn't have money to pay for it. And now they're cutting the staff already. Trinity is doing that. Genesis is doing that. What are we going to do when we don't have enough nurses and doctors to take care of us, even if we've got health insurance?
The issue with Medicare and Medicaid is a serious issue. And I hope you all kind of follow this issue pretty closely. Senator Harkin and Senator Grassley actually have worked for many, many years to balance out the inequity that Iowa has in its reimbursement rate. It has been those efforts, I hate to say understandably, when you go to a Congress and you ask them to, you know, the states that make more than Iowa, that we're going to take money from you in order that Iowa boost up, they don't haven't had the votes to pass that. It is not an issue that is new to either of any of your elected officials here in Iowa. Most of them have worked very hard towards changing that inequity. Tom is very confident that finally, if we are talking about an overall health care reform, that we will finally have an opportunity to seriously address the Medicare. And the reimbursement is not the only issue with the Medicare system that needs to be addressed. I mean, you talk with hospital administrators and the amount of their budgets that's put towards literally administering that program on an individual hospital basis. Some of that's ridiculous. We need to look at that waste that is put in to whether it's questionnaires or reporting or the rankings and all of those systems. Those need to be, and Tom is committed to seeing that all of that is reviewed in this system. It's been going on for far too long, and it is time that we truly do something about it.
Well, I'm going to let some of these other folks have their say. I think I've had mine. So.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Yes.
I work in physician recruitment, and wondering if you can tell me any ideas that Tom might have on how we can address primary care physician shortage versus the specialty care, because of the difference in reimbursements and what a primary care physician can make versus a specialist. You know, we're getting down to a crisis in being able to find primary care for our communities. Is there anything in the bill that would address the inequity between primary care and specialty care that would help push more physicians back to the primary care site?
I'm curious, I mean, you feel that it's the reimbursement rate that really is, it is their ability to make money that is directing
Absolutely.
Doctors where they go. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's around the fact that these doctors come out of medical school with, you know, $100,000 and $200,000 in loans that they need to repay. Primary care doc, you know, comes into practice, they're going to make $160,000 versus a neurosurgeon who might make, you know,
$600,000.
Okay. So the specialty care really is reimbursed in a much higher rate.
I understand your focus is in physician recruitment. That's just one aspect of the whole healthcare. I mean, we have nurses as well, a great shortage of nurses. And how do we create incentives for students, people to want to go into these fields? There are programs that are currently out there that, you know, in some cases they work. You know, they're kind of a hit and miss, I have to tell you. I work with education classes with people who are struggling to pay back student loans, whether it's a nurse or a teacher or anyone. There are some programs that are out there, but they're quite limited. Tom is very committed to expanding those. And we have always, there have always been specialty areas. I mean, we look at the needs of individual communities in the intuition assistance programs. That we look at certain communities and we see that there's a shortage of this, you know, whether it's a podiatrist or whatever, in this community. Then that targeted community, we will see what we can do to recruit a physician to that area and to help him pay. And sometimes it's up to, I think it's $5,000, not to max out the $10,000 a month, to pay back those student loans. We need to expand on that. I mean, that's what I'm hearing from you. And to really focus on primary care physicians.
Or somehow adjust the reimbursement scale so they're not, so everybody's not incented to be a specialist as opposed to a primary care provider.
Okay.
Allison?
Yes.
On that same subject, you know, in terms of the business supply, I mean, there's a couple of different dimensions to this. I mean, reimbursement in terms of physicians to pay key element of that, but when you look at the federal level in terms of the funding residency programs and in terms of the slots that are being paid and the dollars that are being cut, I mean, I just recently read a news article entitled Physician Recruitment Strategy and the Issues That Are Going On, and they selected several specialties, primary care being one of them, but like pulmonary medicine, people that speak. Take care of folks that have lung disorders. It was amazing to read that the number of training slots, people that are actually in those places, are down like 39%. We only train maybe 140, 150 pulmonologists that come out each year, but the slots are down to like 80 something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is a very multifaceted issue when it comes to physician supply. I mean, the reimbursement coming out is key. Training slots, and also the fact, as we heard earlier, the cost of education. I mean, we're dealing with problems after the fact, but again, being a physician here in the audience, but looking at the cost to train someone today, it's just horrendous. As you mentioned, it's not uncommon to be $200,000 in debt coming out, whether you're going to be a specialist or going to be a primary care. It's still a huge amount of debt, and with the pressure from the federal government, pushing down obviously reimbursement taking care of folks, not just at the hospital level, but at the condition level. So you're sitting there with a stagnant amount of debt. We need to reduce more conditions. I just think that if we're going to address the problem, we need to address the entry point and not just the exit point.
That's a very good point, Morris. You know, it is working with universities and medical schools and what we can do to help reduce the upfront cost on that. It is very complex because we have medical schools that are struggling to stay, you know, to survive as well. What do you see as a possible solution?
Well, I think you mentioned one, and I think there needs to be a more collective arrangement. I don't know how people always kind of frequently say the government. Somebody needs to sit down with the organized entities for medical education to be able to figure out a way in which people are not sitting with some staggering debt, independent of what they may go into in terms of their training. Whether they're going to be primary, going to be a gastroenterologist, pulmonologist, whatever. Because I can tell you what's going to end up happening is that you're not going to have enough people, qualified people, people you want to see enter into medical school, provide the care that we're all going to need. I mean, when I look at across the spectrum of the reduction in not only training spots, or just the reduction in the number of people that are actually going after those spots compared to population growth. From 2000 to 2009, the population in the United States has increased by 8%. When you look at the physician population growth, you're talking no more than about 1 or 2% when you look across all the specialties.
Is this something that you see that we need to start earlier in our educational system? And more emphasis on the sciences, on health sciences?
Well, that's part of it, but there's also people who are also learning to the issues of healthcare as to do I want to even go into the profession. You know, they look at the barriers, and then you obviously is the cost to be able to fund that. And knowing that when they come out, all the other difficulties that they may have to deal with, partly obviously have to take back that debt. One other thing I want to put out there, and I'll
Can you give me 1 second to address it, though? I think we need to be somewhat, I don't know that it is fair to the taxpayers to, there's going to be a balance here. I don't have an answer, I'll tell you that. But there's going to have to be a balance that's reached here. And to go to the taxpayers and say to pick back a specialist who it could be making, you know, $300,000, I don't know, what could a specialist
possibly make? No, someone could make $600,000 to $800,000
a year. That the government's, you know, the taxpayers are going to pay that physician back for their tuition. So I think that your point about doing something ahead of, you know, in advance, what we can do to try to recruit people into the health professions, particularly physicians, that's going to, really, I think we need to turn to some of the physicians.
And you have that problem
answers.
With nursing, because
yes.
You know, nurses, I know, earn less, but they also are sitting with a staggering amount of debt, whether they're in a 2-year program or a 4-year program. The other comment, independent of the provider supply, physician, nurses, et cetera, has to do with public policy. And I was listening to a gentleman the other day, which makes so much sense. As we talk about wellness, which you brought up, it's interesting, you know, when you look at other countries in terms of how they've attacked that piece, and they've made public policy part of it. For example, when we talk about smoking, and I know a lot of doctors deal with their patients and trying to get them to not smoke, which we know is going to interfere with a lot of, and create a lot of health conditions, whether people want to recognize that or not. But some countries have gotten very progressive about that to the point where, you know, folks are not allowed to smoke in an open area in the country. If you smoke at home, for example. But at some point, somebody's got to start making some of the hard decisions. And I know that stuff in a country like ours would be considered to be free, and people should be allowed to make those kind of decisions. But the point is, we're in a situation now where we've already rattled off $2.2 trillion, 16-17%. We're on a path that we're probably going to be 20-25%. We're probably going to be at $5 trillion. At some point, where does it end? And when does people start taking responsibility for their own health? And if you talk to physicians, nurses, and others who actually take care of the patients, you know, where does the responsibility fall on the others? And you're trying to provide this care, but you're doing it in a sick model. Now we want to try to move more to a wellness model. At the same time, when we do that, you're going to have to address this in public policy at the same time. I think both of these have to be running simultaneously.
Of course, this is not an issue that's going to be addressed immediately. where do we legislate and where do we educate? And what can we do to help make or help individuals and families, you know, collectively make smarter and better choices towards taking care of themselves? Tom has had some successes, little things, to the point of, where he has the elevators at the Heart Senate office building in Washington. He had them put up signs that if, you know, you're going to the third floor and you took the stairs, you'd burn this many calories. I mean, businesses that start doing the walking paths and have heart and wellness grants, something that he has worked to get funding for those. These are little changes. He's had, just last week he had a major success in working with the American Restaurant Association. And they have signed on to his proposal that when you go to a marquee in a fast food restaurant or even on the menu, the caloric value of every item is going to be listed next to it. You know, they made some steps a couple of years ago saying that they had to make it available to their customers. Well, now it's going to be right up there. It'll be helping people make smarter choices about that. We need to, at some point in time, yes, there is personal responsibility in this. Exactly where that line is, where you legislate it and you require somebody to go see a doctor and you require, that's a tough call to make.
I hear you, but I listened to the gentleman up front row, but, being retired, being on fixed income, all of us at some point are going to be in that boat. And we'll all end up paying for the system. And there's only so many dollars, and at some point, the hard decisions just have to be made.
No, and I mean, seriously, I haven't asked, what are those hard decisions that you, seriously would see, want your government to be making? Yes? Either one?
Why don't you go ahead, because I want to spend more time talking.
Okay. Well, I think one of the hard decisions takes place at the end of life. And I'm a chaplain and I do a lot of advanced directives, largely because of my own experience with my mother, who had a second major stroke. She had an advanced directive that was buried in a drawer someplace. And so she was resuscitated again, kept in an ICU for 2 weeks on a ventilator with, as the doctor told me, the gold standard of antibiotics. For 10 days, the bill was $40,000. This was 11 years ago. I said, my goodness, this culture cannot sustain this kind of expense that wasn't intended to begin with. She was supposed to have a do not resuscitate order that was not locatable at the time. It's that outrageous expense at the end of life, to me, that needs to be looked at. That hospitals is probably not too popular for some people, but just because we can do something doesn't mean we should do something.
I think there needs to be a bigger focus on educating about advanced directives to everyone, and there needs to be a more uniform way of those documents being available. Because I know from an admission standpoint, when we admit patients, they're at home, we don't have a copy, they may never bring them in. If something happens, we're caught between what their wishes are, but not having anything that says that that's their wishes.
Is this something, we've made great strides towards electronic record keeping. Is this something that can be kept in there, in the app?
If we get a copy, one copy to begin with.
Instead, a whole idea, I think, Allison, that we talked about in terms of, using something like Iowa Health has a fiber optic network throughout the state. So if I end up in a hospital in Cedar Rapids and they can pull up my medical record, and which has advanced directives, so that I don't end up being resuscitated if I don't want to.
Is that currently?
No.
That's not available.
That's okay. The funding that's going to be necessary around electronic medical record and electronic health record for us to be able to provide that.
That is a very, very important issue, I think, that needs to be taken up in the country. I don't know that this is something for our government necessarily to start saying setting a level at what point you're no longer going to be providing medical services. education. I think that you're right on. We need to be educating the individuals about that. And, you know, whether it's with infants, you know, preemies, or whether we're talking about, you know, your 100-year-old great-great-grandma.
Well, you know, we've done this with organ donation in terms of our driver's licenses, you know, in some states, so that, you know, you don't even have to sign the back of your driver's license anymore. It's automatically in the system through the Secretaries of State. So the same could be true in terms of trans directives. You know, what do you want, Jeff? And if, you know, and it feeds into that whole thing about being an organ donor.
And maybe there's more education regarding what exactly advanced directives is. Because I don't know that every patient that I come in contact really knows what it means to have CPR done, what it means to be put on the ventilator. And maybe from that aspect, they knew what was going to happen to them. They would really want those decisions made beforehand.
We have done great things when it comes to public health. Somebody said you're never gonna change people's minds. You can't change people's behaviors. They're gonna continue to do what they've always done before. And I was just saying, you know, I know that we can do this. You know, just look at Sunny. You know, I don't know about you, but when I was in high school, we used to lather ourselves in baby oil and sit out in the sun. And we had a public health campaign that talked about the dangers of doing this. And I have to tell you, you find sunscreen in just about every lotion and all makeup and everything that is out there. That was an education, and education does work. We need to focus that perhaps more, draw on the expertise of, you know, professionals as well as consumers about what works. We can sell the notion of the stuff. People struggle. Sometimes I struggle, you know.
Can I just finish my comment? It does fit into a federal plan because part of Obama's 3 points of prevention, universality, and this is the quality versus quantity.
Uh-huh.
You know, the fear that doctors need to do everything because they might miss something, and therefore the fear of lawsuits or whatever. And so it's a quality, it's a decision that needs to be made before 90% of the treatment that is done is decided to be unnecessary. The early decision, and it can come from the federal guidelines and assistance, I think, from that.
Is this something that you see? Do we need to have this discussion across the gamut in all areas of our life? Is this something that we should be encouraging health professionals to talk with their patients about?
Yeah, because somebody can have a living will, and if they haven't had that discussion with the doctor is, as in my case, I was threatened with an ethics committee review because our family had asked the doctor to remove my mother from life support.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I can't do that. We have to have an ethics committee review. I said, terrific. Let's have one. And then he came in and said, okay, I guess we can do that. And so doctors need to be convinced that they don't, somehow, I don't know, these people know a lot better than I do how a doctor is convinced they don't have to keep my mother on life support.
Yeah, you know, it's the whole issue of 80% of the healthcare dollars spent in the last 6 months of life.
Yeah, it's just so disproportionate.
What's the quality of that life in the last 6 months?
But those are very serious, you know, bioethic questions.
And we're talking about dollars spent. I mean, that's the real issue. I mean, huge cost of healthcare is because of that, so we have to.
And it's not as, and I don't know, again, there can be direction, there can be education. I don't know that we're going to see a federal that says it, you know, we're only going to try for so long, we're only going to try so much treatment. I don't think we ever want to get to that point. And I know that that's not really where you're going, but you're correct. And this is an issue that's been brought up in several meetings, too. Yes, thanks for your patience.
My name is Mike Cassidy. I'm a gastroenterologist. I'm a physician, and I'd like to spend 5 to 10 minutes. I'm going to tell you what the answer is. You don't have to write any notes. I've got something for you to take with you afterwards. Okay, a little bit about myself. I'm a retired Army colonel. I spent 20 years in the military, so I know socialized medicine very well. I was overseas for 10 years and involved with other collaborative efforts with other hospitals in Europe. I've done internal medicine for 25 years. I was in private practice with another partner in Clinton for a number of years. I've joined also with a multi-specialty group and am currently with a single specialty gastroenterology group in Moline. Born, raised, educated, currently live in Iowa. Now, I've been into some forums. I went to the one in Rock Island 2 months ago. A lot of comments, a lot of good ideas. But in general, the people in the room are clueless on putting this together. Now, what's the problem? First of all, it's the cost of care is just astronomical. Last week, I received a cold letter from a person here in Davenport who wanted to barter with me for medical care. You just mentioned that the number of bankruptcies is fairly related to the medical catastrophes in this country. I'm a baby boomer. There's going to be 60 million of us headed towards retirement. Estimated cost, 30 to 60 trillion. I can't comprehend that number. I personally have 2 health insurance plans just to protect myself, TRICARE and Blue Cross. Okay? Now, the forum in Rock Island clearly brought through 3 points: access, cost, quality. In general, we're only going to be able to get 2 if you try and do this legislatively with massive, quote, transfer of wealth, the government takes care of it, the government will oversee it. Now, in my opinion, nobody is addressing the issues, and I'll give you the 6 issues, which you touched on a little bit. And I'm going to give you my answers to that. It's going to be a give and take on the 6 different issues. Nobody's going to win completely. Everybody's going to lose something. Okay? Now, insurance. Okay, insurance companies can't cherry pick. The only role government should be in is to guarantee against catastrophic losses. Okay? They should push the health savings accounts as much as they can to get people involved in that. There's incentive in that because if they stay healthy, they get the money later in their life, or at least their grandkids get it. That's not being done. Insurance companies are not promoting it. Right away, you incentivize the patient, you keep the insurance companies involved, you cover them a little bit, and you forbid them to cherry pick insurance. Number 2, government. The only role is to cover catastrophic situations, help keep the costs down. Number 3, I could talk all day about this one, but anyway, tort reform. We have got to have caps. 15 to 20% of what I do every day is defensive medicine. I invite you, Allison, to follow me around. I will point out to you directly why I'm doing this, and a lot of it is because I've got to cover my 6 or I'm going to get sued. Now, and that's easily 12 to 20% of the cost of medicine is basically because of defensive medicine. It's a total waste of money. It's because of nuisance suits. There needs to be an amendment to the Constitution of the United States that he who loses pays. Level the playing field. If you've got such a beef that you want to go to court, fine. But he who loses is going to pay the court costs. Interestingly, in Britain, that money goes to the government. Wait until Mr. Harkin hears about that. The patient. We're in the midst of an obesity epidemic. Every good thing that's happened in my 33 years of medical practice has just been flushed. CAT scans, drugs, procedures, and everything. Our longevity is going backwards. We're 40th in the world. We're getting nothing for our dollar. It's because people are eating themselves out of existence, quite frankly. They're not accountable. It's a me society. They're doing whatever they can. Safeway President has made their employees more accountable. Direct payment of insurance plans based on their risk assessment, meaning smoking, weight, activity level, and other issues. that's got to be ingrained in the patient. We tried to do an obesity clinic at our practice, didn't go anywhere. Nobody's incentivized. Even though I screamed at them to tell them that if you don't get the weight off, you're going to go bankrupt just because of the cost of drugs to take care of diabetes and heart disease. So the patient has got to be hugely incentivized to get to start behaving correctly. Pharmaceutical industry, again, I could talk all day about it. They're dumping expensive drugs in this country and making us pay for it. They're getting them at pennies anywhere else in the world. Now, it's why my mother's alive. There's 20 to 30 categories of miracle drugs that are blockbusters. They're spectacular. They were dreams of mine only 30 years ago. Now, they obviously need a right to investigate, get them to market, and get them on the shelf and make sure they're protected. And I'm not talking against that, but the dumping of drugs and making us pay for it in this country is obscene. The corporate headquarters are all overseas. We can't get to their books. We can't account on what they're doing.
What do you mean by dumping of drugs?
Pardon me?
Dumping of drugs.
Well, I would invite you to buy a Nexium tablet, which I prescribe routinely, $4 a pill, mm-hmm. and travel to Europe and maybe pick it up on the street for 20 cents.
Okay, I just want to make sure you're wrong.
Yeah, it's a cost differential. I don't know how we're going to reel them in. They, with all due respect, they've done a spectacular job, but there's some inequities that are going on around the world as far as who's paying for their drugs.
Can I answer that quickly
sure.
for you with the provision that is in this bill?
Yes.
There's actually a cap that is placed on the advertising percentage of the company's income that they can put on in advertising. I don't know.
No, absolutely, and I'm all for it. I'm also, understand, there's 4 divisions of drug reps in this country, 60,000 people. Being on my door every day for me to market their drugs.
Right.
They do a wonderful job in education, but that whole ethical scene has got to be, I think Senator Grassley is trying to control that, if not Senator Harper. Mm-hmm. Now, finally, the physicians. Well, you knew I would come to that at some point. And here's my novel suggestion. The dirty little secret out there is we in the medical system, physicians, we can't write off bad debt. As professionals, we can charge whatever we want. Okay? But there's some rule, some law, some standard that we can't write off bad debt. Now, the perspective is this. We do a lot of pro bono work. Through the ERs, the hospitals, sometimes patients get in our clinic, and we take care of them. We can't reduce their care. Once they're in, we've got to take care of them. Okay, but somewhere within the system, that's got to be paid for by overhead, or if they hit hospital ERs, again, that's why everything is so hugely, another reason why everything is so hugely expensive. The 46 million people that don't have insurance, tying up ERs, don't know where to go, and so forth. Now, it's my prediction that physicians would see anybody if they could write off Medicare rates, in other words, 30 cents on the dollar, off their business expenses. Instead of having a collection agency track down somebody that they'll never find in 10 years for a bill, okay, you're in. The beauty of it is this. You don't need an ID card. You get the illegal immigrants taken care of. You get foreigners that are visiting taken care of. You get grandma down the street or a young teenager that doesn't have insurance taken care of. Let the physician or clinic or medical system write off Medicare rates off their business expense. It's understandable. Again, this is part of the perversion of medical practice. Most people don't understand the hoops we go through. We can't even function like a regular business who normally writes off bad debt.
And do you see that is the solution, or do we need to increase the reimbursement rate that you have?
Well,
would you prefer?
Let me finish up a little bit more too.
Okay.
It's my suspicion that once you do that, you get the 46 million going someplace. Now, not every doctor would participate. It would be voluntary, and to the limit of whatever he wants, voluntary. But there are doctors that would be happy to see more patients, whether it's rural or urban or wherever, and you better match the flow of the patient with where the need availability is. Meanwhile, you get them out of the expensive clinics or ERs. All of a sudden, guess what? That overhead starts coming down, and they, and that forces them to be more competitive with their pricing. And so it's very transparent. What does the taxpayer pay? Only the reduction in taxes that the clinic or physician is going to pay. All of a sudden, you've got 46 million people covered. Think of the logic. Now, we're not talking of, and again, these suggestions I've just provided to you, in my estimate, would basically reduce the cost of medical care in this country 30 to 40%. If you get people working, tort reform, write-offs for physicians, medical clinics or hospitals, and the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, I've yet to hear where anybody is talking about cutting costs. All they're doing is transferring wealth. The points I've just elicited would effectively cut the cost that's coming to all of us. And I will be glad to argue with anybody if they want to challenge me on some of these points. You can't pick one or two or three. They've all got to go together. Insurance, government, patients, physicians, pharmaceutical, and the lawyers. And if you don't get those six parties involved, you're wasting your time and our money. Any questions?
No, I agree with you. As a matter of fact, before this session started, I was on the phone with one of our physicians who was telling me because of the issue of lack of reimbursement, was not going to take care of the patient. He was not obligated. He was not, given the scenario that was presented to me. He just wanted me to be aware of it. So I think he's absolutely right. What I was saying earlier, if you want to take on all these issues and work them together, if you only take pieces of it, we're not going to end up with the desired result that we need to get to. Because I can tell you, if we do this in piecemeal, we don't take on all those areas that has now just been mentioned, and there's probably a couple others, and some of it obviously ties into public policy, we're going to be on a path that no one is going to be able to. We're there already.
Doctor, I think that that's truly why this is called, a comprehensive health care reform bill. I truly think that this administration, I know that my boss is welcome the opportunity to finally take a look at the entire health care system, at where we can be saving money, unnecessary testing and treatments that you are required to do because of a lawyer or an insurance policy, a malpractice policy that requires you to do that. It is forcing you to make medical decisions that I don't think you ever intended to do when you were in medical school, and that those things need to be changed. Tort reform is not addressed in this bill, I'll tell you, because that will come out of the Judiciary Committee, and that's a separate committee. This is directly on the medical aspect of this. I will tell you this is an issue that has come up in every single, except on the consumer. I've had some just consumers.
I'll be straight with you. Our country is going to hell in a handbasket because nobody can make an honest decision anymore, and it's because of our tort system. I thought of developing a class action suit with my insurance company against one of the states, and maybe run it up to the Supreme Court. The bottom line, the whole system puts me as a target for nuisance lawsuits. 6 years ago when I changed jobs, I paid $100,000 a year in insurance. Tail, malpractice, medical, dental, car. You got the picture? Okay, this is ridiculous. And my record is clean. Now, what are we dying for? We're paying for nuisance suits. They're occurring. Open the paper. It's on every page. Read between the lines.
Well, Doctor, can I ask?
Yes.
And I will tell you, Senator Harkin has made a statement that this is very, this is not an easy question or an easy situation to decide. I mean, who puts a value, when we talk about putting a cap, who puts a value on a life? And I don't think that Tom wants to be responsible for doing that. There are other proposals that are out there about frivolous lawsuits that are filed. California, I know, currently has a system.
They're doing a better job.
Yeah, but there is a review board of both medical professionals that actually review a lawsuit to find if there are actual medical grounds with which they should be even moved forward into the regular court system. Would you favor something like that?
At least as a beginning. But, I mean, our whole federal system, our whole judicial system needs to wake up and needs to go, he who loses pays to get people.
Well, and as somebody, as a doctor pointed out to me yesterday, I mean, it is still your loss. If you go to court, and I'm glad that your record's clean, but if you go to court, you have losses anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
And if these are frivolous, there are many attorneys who would support, a three-strike, you're out. Kind of a policy that if an attorney files three frivolous malpractice suits, that they are disbarred or fined or penalized in some way for doing that. So there are people out there shopping for it. On the other hand, we have to also admit that there are egregious errors that are made, and that unfortunately people do suffer. And I know that you are not talking about taking away that option for recourse for that family. But finding some balance.
It's way out of balance right now.
It is way out.
And we're all paying for this.
Yes, we are.
And we can't afford it.
Right. Okay. Message delivered, and I'd be happy to take whatever you have.
Uh-oh.
I appreciate it. I hate to tell you, I need to get to another meeting in a few minutes. Can I let you know the Senator Harkin website, tomharkin.senate.gov? You can go there and stay updated on how this bill is progressing. The most important button, though, on that website is to share a message with Tom. If you have a thought that you didn't get to share today, or if there is an issue that comes to you in a couple of days, please take a moment to share that with Tom. Let him know you attended a meeting and this was an outcome of something that was discussed here today. I will take these notes. You can also in the Davenport office for Senator Harkin, too. You're welcome to call. I'd be more than happy to talk to anyone. I will get you a response to your letter. I promise. I'll talk to you in a second. And if I can get your information.
What a great assignment.